This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter offer code ARTOFMAN at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So if you spend some time on the internet, you've probably come across phrases like microaggressions or trigger warnings or safe spaces and the like. And it's really interesting. It's you're seeing a lot on college campuses where basically you're seeing some segment of the college population who are very sensitive emotionally to slights or even just awkward social encounters, and it triggers them psychologically or emotionally. Two sociologists have gotten together, named Bradley Campbell and Jason Manning, and they recently published a paper, a theory as to why this, what they call victimhood culture, has arisen on college campuses. It was really interesting, so I had to have them on the show. Today on the podcast, we discuss these various moral cultures. We talk about honor and masculinity. We talk about what makes up a dignity culture, and we talk about why they think this culture of victimhood is arising in our country and how it's a combination, a weird combination of honor culture and dignity culture. And we discuss some of the implications of this victimhood culture and what it means for how we handle conflict within our society. Really fascinating discussion. Think you're going to enjoy it. So without further ado, Bradley Campbell and Jason Manning and victimhood culture. Bradley Campbell, Jason Manning, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So you both are our sociologists. Can you tell us a little bit about what brought you two together? Because you're on like separate parts of the country. One of you's on the West Coast, one of you's on the East Coast. How did you guys get together and start writing about, particularly we're going to talk about the victimhood culture, but moral cultures in general?
So Jason and I went to graduate school together at the University of Virginia and studied under Donald Black. And Black has done a lot of work in the sociology of law, but what Black does and what we do generally is to study conflict, how people handle moral conflicts. And so we've done work mostly in violence, and done it separately. I've written about genocide. Jason has written about suicide. But in the course of our work and our courses, we've dealt with these ideas of dignity and honor a lot, honor cultures. So when you're studying violence, one of the things you immediately see is that it's connected a lot of times with honor, which is a kind of reputation for physical bravery. So you can think about in societies where they fought duels. I mean, that's just one example. But the idea that people need to maintain this reputation for bravery, what it ends up meaning is that slights are very important. And a lot of honor disputes are about insults and slights, and people use violence in response to these. And so, but a lot of people had said that the transition to a culture of dignity, there's still pockets of honor among street gangs and stuff. But so in dignity culture, you ignore slights, you ignore insults. But we started seeing these microaggression complaints, which we'll talk about in some other things that we see as manifestations of this new culture of victimhood. And it wasn't like honor, it wasn't like dignity. People were not ignoring slights, but they also weren't responding to them violently. So we saw something new is arising. There's some kind of new moral culture of it.
Okay, so let's dig into this a little bit deeper about the different types of cultures. So you started off talking about honor cultures, and you make the case that this was the first type of moral culture that we had, the type of culture we use to resolve conflict. And you describe some of the characteristics, right? If it's honor, I guess it's really hard for people to in the modern West to understand honor, because whenever they hear honor, I think they often think like integrity. Right, I'm a man of honor. I'll keep my word, but we're talking about something. It's a, like you said, a reputation, but it's a certain type of reputation. Can you guys go into a little deeper about what that reputation meant and why it was so important that you had to defend that reputation?
Well, you see, this classical notion of honor, which is not incompatible with reputation for sincerity or honesty or other things we associate with honor today. But the core of it in earlier times and places, and today in certain times and places where law is weak or absent, is maintaining this reputation for toughness, a kind of pugnacity, a willingness to defend oneself at the drop of a hat. And you tend to find it exactly in those places where people rely on toughness as a means of protecting themselves, their family. It's a way of deterring predation or attack from other people. And so one of the characteristics of these honor settings is that there's not a stable or reliable legal system in place, not a way of peacefully resolving conflicts or deterring predation. And so people rely on this reputation for being tough as a way of protecting themselves. You see it in the classical form in, say, medieval societies or ancient societies. And you see a modern form of it in various low-income, high-violence neighborhoods in the United States. Recently, a journalist, Jill Leovi, wrote a book about homicide in South L.A., for instance. She speaks of the need for young men to act tough when they walk the streets and project an image of being willing to retaliate quickly and severely in order to protect themselves in these high-crime areas.
And this is curious, because, I mean, is it... Is that why honor, so I'm guessing that's why honor existed in the past, because particularly in America, there was an established law enforcement, really. We didn't have the police force like we did today. So if you wanted to protect yourself, you had to do it on your own.
Right. And historically, the state was weakest in the South, which is where honor was the strongest.
Yeah. And isn't there, I mean, I don't know if this has been sort of disputed by some sociologists recently, but there's a theory that, you know, Southerners embrace honor because police state is weak, but also most of the migrants or most of the people who immigrated to the South were from Scotland and they were herders. Is there anything to that whole herder culture? Is it something that it encourages an honor culture?
Yes, I'd say they almost certainly brought this culture with them and reproduced it to some extent in the South. And that's one of the ideas. Yeah, I mean, I guess it is disputed, but even, you know, the southeastern part of the United States still has more, you know, higher rates of violence than other parts of the country. And the South, across the United States, because they migrated west, the same people. And so there is the idea that there's this, that kind of, you know, spreading of the culture, and yet it would have been rooted in herding societies that they came from.
Yeah.
And you find cross-culturally that herding societies often have this emphasis on strength because animals are movable property and easily stolen.
Yeah. Yeah. So like the cowboys and the farmers, right? The cowboys are typically more rambunctious. Ranchers are more prone to, like, if you someone steals their horses, they're going to hang you. Farmers are sort of typically known to be peaceful, thinking in the long term. Mm-hmm. Probably helped embrace or bring in the dignity culture.
Mm-hmm.
To an extent. Well, and so, I mean, I guess it makes sense during a time when the police or the state is at its lowest, an honor culture would exist. I mean, that was the only way you can... remedy wrongs is if you use self-help, like you all say. But what's the downside of this? I mean, there is a dark side to honor cultures, particularly going beyond just retributive violence, but that can create a vicious cycle. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes.
Certainly.
It's the big downside is that it's associated with a lot of violence. And, in a certain society where there's not law, you can see why you need to maintain this reputation for toughness and engage in violence, maybe to prevent more in the future and to prevent yourself from being victimized. But it can also lead, to a chain of violence where there's retaliation for one act of violence that leads to retaliation for another. In clan-based societies, there are tribal societies. There's often blood feuding where one clan, a member of one clan has killed a member of another clan. The response is that people from the clan of the victim go and kill somebody from the clan of the killer. Well, then they respond then by killing somebody from the other clan, and it keeps going back and forth and can do so until they come up with some kind of truce. And you see this in the inner cities. Jason mentioned the book Ghetto Side by Jill Leovoy. It's very recent, but the idea is again, you have this, especially when you know, when homicides aren't dealt with by the state, when people aren't punished for them, you end up having this chain of retaliation that leads to a lot more violence overall than it would be if it's just quickly suppressed by the state.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, the reason why we've written extensively about honor, sort of the history of traditional honor, because it's so tied up with masculinity, right? You talk about the characteristics in an honor culture that are prized are strength, courage, willingness to retaliate against slights. You say there still exists in pockets of the modern West, like particularly gangs, where honor cultures exist in their fullest. But I've noticed that even amongst people like us, right, we're college educated white guys, who there's like twinges of it a bit, right? Like there's like, if a guy gets called a chicken, like that stings for some reason. Even though, you know,
we've
it's
all
like
got a little honor in us.
There, yeah, we all still have a little bit of it in us. And I think it's interesting. I don't know if it's like a biological thing or if it's a cultural thing. It's interesting.
It's one of the things that, you know, when we're talking about like an honor culture, we see honor as something that, you know, it's sort of valued over other things. So it's still often, a kind of status in other settings. It's, bravery is something that is still important, and even your reputation for it. And yeah, even when you're taught, so if you're in more of a culture of dignity where you're taught, don't respond violently, brush off insults. Yeah, I mean, like you're saying, I think we all have these moments where our blood boils and we can, completely angry, And, you know, the difference is that we have that kind of thing, society is telling us to not to respond, right? And when we think of what we're supposed to do morally. And if you're in an honor culture, though, if the full-blown culture of honor, you would, it would be shameful for you not to respond. Your family would expect it. Other people would too, because you would lose status. It wouldn't be just about a kind of a momentary feeling of anger that you would want.
Yeah. And you guys made this point in the paper as well, is that although honor culture doesn't really exist in the West and even in most industrial countries, it does exist, and it doesn't exist for people. It still exists on a nation state level, right? Countries are always really concerned about, China, or, we just had it in the news recently, the U.S. like went into like Chinese territory, and the Chinese are like, we're going to do something to show that we saw that and you can't respect us. And I guess it's because at a nation state level, there isn't a higher authority you can really go to, correct?
Correct. States, oddly enough, exist in a stateless society. There is no common court system they can go to. I mean, there are international organizations, but they have little real authority of any kind. And so states do still show this concern with maintaining their reputation and with being able to respond to aggression in a aggressive manner.
Yeah, it is. So yeah, if people want to see honor culture manifest, just watch international politics. We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Guys, when I first built The Art of Manliness, I had to create the website by myself, and I didn't know any HTML or CSS or PHP, and I had to teach myself, and resulting in breaking my site over and over and over again. I wish there was something like Squarespace when I started The Art of Manliness, because it would have made it a lot easier. Squarespace allows you to create a professional-looking website without any coding. It's all point and click, and best of all, it's responsive, so it's going to look great on a desktop, your smartphone, or a tablet. Squarespace offers 24/7 support, so if you ever run into troubles, you can call someone and actually talk to a human being. So if you're looking to start a business, show off your portfolio, if you're a photographer or an artist, or if you just want to have a website where, to put your resume out there, go check out Squarespace. And if you want to get a discount on it, go to squarespace.com and use offer code ARTOFMAN at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase. Again, that's squarespace.com, offer code ARTOFMAN for 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Also buy Thursday boots. All right, so fall's here, winter's coming, and one of the things you can do to up your style game is to buy a nice pair of dress boots. Goes great with a pair of dark denim jeans, sport coat, and you're going to look really, really nice. The problem with dress boots is that you're given the choice between either a really affordable, cheap boot that's going to fall apart after a few wears, or the high quality, high priced boot that costs $400, $500 that's not affordable for the average guy. Well, Thursday Boot has solved this problem by offering a great-looking, well-built boot at an affordable price. It's handcrafted with some of the best leather, tier one grade A USA cattle leather, Goodyear well construction, glove leather interior lining, and they just look handsome. I got a pair. I'm loving them so far, and they're comparable to some of the high-dollar boots that I also have. If you want to see a selection of my favorite boots, go to thursdayboots.com/AOM. The prices there start at $149. You get free shipping and returns, so you can definitely find something within your budget. Again, thursdayboots.com/AOM. Okay, so let's talk. We've talked about honor culture. The second type of moral culture that we transitioned to after honor culture was what you all called dignity culture. And you mentioned that one of the characteristics is that you don't use violence. But what are some of the other characteristics of a dignity culture, and why did it arise?
Yeah, one thing we should point out is that people use these terms differently. I mean, as you mentioned before, you know, we talk about honor meaning something else all the time, integrity or something. And so we're using honor and dignity in a very specific sense here. We didn't invent these terms used in this way, but other people use them differently. So when we're talking about dignity, then it's something very different from a reputation for bravery. The idea is that with dignity is that everybody has this moral worth. It's just inherent to you as a human being, and it can't be taken away from you if somebody insults you or something. So your reputation matters less. And again, these are our tendencies. And so, and this exists in an environment where you do have strong state authority. So the idea is, if there's a serious offense, if there's violence against you, someone harms you, someone steals from you, you go to the police, you go to the courts. But if it's not very serious, then maybe just ignore it. And so that's what ends up happening in a dignity culture. And almost every, it's often just completely the opposite of honor culture in terms of the morality that's taught. So instead of being told that you must defend your reputation, you're told to ignore insults. You know, sticks and stones will break my bones, words will never hurt me. And so, in a lot of senses, it's the exact opposite of the culture of honor. Jason.
It's important to emphasize too, I think, and I've read some of Brett's work on personal honor, or what he calls private honor, and the importance of reputation in a contemporary setting. But in what we're calling dignity cultures, your reputation might matter, but it can't be harmed by what others do to you. You can harm your own reputation through your own actions by doing something that's a violation of moral rules, but you cannot have your reputation shattered by others harming you. It's them who are in the wrong and not you. Versus in an honor culture, you're the one who experiences shame if you've been victimized by others.
And it's up to you then to demonstrate with a show of violence often, if somebody has insulted you, even if they're wrong. Whereas the idea in a dignity culture would be, if they're wrong, then ignore it. Who cares?
Yeah, and if you responded to them, you would be lowering yourself to their level.
Yeah.
And be undignified.
By the law, yeah.
Right. And I mean, I guess, where police state or the state is strong, dignity cultures will rise. I'm guessing democracy or this idea of egalitarianism is another prerequisite, right? That the idea that people are value in and of themselves, they have worth, and that doesn't matter. Rank doesn't matter. It's just you have worth. So is that another prerequisite to democracy and egalitarianism?
Yes, honor and dignity both are connected to equality, egalitarianism in a sense, in that honor disputes are between equals, but they're often in a stratified society where, so there's this exclusive group that has honor and other people who are below them, slaves or whatever, don't. And so, with the with democracy, you end up having the idea that everybody has worth and so when there's not an exclusive group that's thought of as having more moral worth of some kind, then I think that's one of the things that weakens honor too.
Is there a time frame here? I know it's really squidgy when you're talking about transitions to moral cultures, but would it be safe to say, like, industrialization in the United States is when you really see that transition from honor culture to dignity culture?
I think starting before industrialization, perhaps, because one of the incidents we mentioned in our paper to illustrate the transition was the duel between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. And this occurred because, you know, both men thought they had to defend their reputations through fighting. And yet after the duel, Burr was vilified for killing Hamilton. So that shift, at least in the northern regions of the country, took place in the early 19th century. But I think you're right that as industrialization picked up, the transition quickened and reached its fullest, especially in until well after the Civil War.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's when police power and state power was actually fully established in the United States. Because, yeah, you're right. Up until about 1900, I mean, it really was the Wild West still here in the West. It wouldn't be for a few years until we would actually have governments, working governments in these really remote areas. So that brings us to victim culture, victimhood culture you're seeing now. So let's talk about the characteristics of victimhood culture and what you saw in the broader culture that made you suspect that we are transitioning to another moral culture to handle conflict.
We began seeing these things on college campuses or coming from them. I mean, one incident occurred in March of 2013, and this is kind of when we started thinking about this. There was an incident at Oberlin College where they shut down the campus, I mean, canceled classes after a student saw someone they believe was wearing a Klan robe. And at the time, we were sort of amazed by this. You know, I mean, it seemed very unlikely that there was a chapter of the Ku Klux Klan at Oberlin College. And it did turn out that, you know, that it was somebody in a bathrobe or a towel or blanket or something. And so there's that you had this idea of people at Oberlin College who thought that they were living in an environment that was kind of a hotbed of racism. Well, at the same time, you know, so we were looking at things and a colleague pointed me toward this Oberlin microaggressions website. This was the first time I had seen the term microaggression. And so these are, the idea is that there are these slights, even unintentional slights that are experienced by minority groups and that they cause real harm. You know, and so the students on the Oberlin microaggressions website were documenting all these little things that they called microaggressions that were examples of racism or some kind other kind of dominance. You know, there was a student who said that she was in the gym and overheard a professor saying that she was glad both she and her husband had blue eyes. And the student then comments and says, "I don't want casual racism in my professors." And you know, there are other incidents like this that were, you know, small matters. If anything, it's kind of a matter of interpretation. But the idea was that they were trying to highlight these things. And so it didn't seem like what we're familiar with as a culture of dignity, where you ignore slights. They weren't, you're not only not ignoring them, broadcasting them, not giving, not giving people the benefit of the doubt on intentions and things like that. And so we thought, you know, what's going on? Is it a culture of honor? You know, so in honor cultures, people are famously sensitive to slight. But obviously, in this case, these people are not responding violently. They're not fighting duels or harming people. They are complaining and complaining to third parties. And so, and they're especially, you know, what you see that's very different from honor cultures. In an honor culture, when you're slighted, you use violence because the whole point is to show that you're not weak. You're not a victim. You're somebody who can handle your own conflicts and your own affairs. And here they were broadcasting their weakness and vulnerability. So you had something that wasn't really honor or dignity, and we began trying to think about what that was and what we would call it and what were the characteristics of this new culture.
Okay, so let's talk about microaggressions. I know it's come into the mainstream recently. I think this year is when you really start seeing it in all the newspapers and magazines and things like that. But for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, you gave one example of microaggression that where a professor said, "I'm glad I have blue eyes." What are some other examples of microaggressions that are common microaggressions?
There are almost too many to keep track of at this point. I was reading a news story day yesterday saying that using the term politically correct is a microaggression. There was recently, politically correct is not politically incorrect.
Yeah.
There is a complaint about the term America is a melting pot, Bradley, that happened in your neck of the woods.
Oh, did it?
There's a document put out by the University of California. It's it was part of a teacher training thing, or, you know, some training for faculty. And it has about 52 examples of microaggressions listed. And yeah, some of them were things like that. America is a melting pot. I don't believe in race. Or I think the most qualified person should get the job. Well, those are probably like the more extreme examples in the sense that those are things that get most disputed. Like people would say these aren't offenses at all. But others, others are things that you might say to people that come across very awkwardly. And one of the things that's given as an example a lot is asking an Asian person, where are you from? Or it can be a Latino or someone. But the idea is that, you know, where are you from? And then they might answer Seattle. And you say, no, where are you really from? And the idea is that you're assuming that they're not American, they don't belong here. That's how it's interpreted. And it can be things like, asking the white mother of a black child, is that child really yours? And things. So they range from things that most of us would think of as, either slightly offensive or at least awkward, you would avoid saying these things to make, and try not to make people uncomfortable if you could. But they range from that to things that are just sort of ordinary, conversation topics. Where are you from can be that too, depending on how it's asked, or political opinions like opposition to affirmative action, that are actually being called microaggressions. But what you see is the commonality is that the idea is that there are people who are in victim groups, so groups that are oppressed or dominated in some way. That's the idea. And that when people from other groups say these things to them, they put them down, they make them feel uncomfortable. And you notice they're calling these things a kind of aggression. We don't usually call it an aggression when you do something unintentional. Like bumping into somebody wouldn't be called a physical aggression, but in this case it is. And part of the idea is that they're saying it does this serious harm to people, even if it's unintentional.
And I'm curious, why has this arisen now? I mean, what is it? What purpose is it serving? Because I understand honor culture, where you need to be sensitive to slights because your reputation is everything. Your life depends on it. Your livelihood will depend on it. The livelihood of your family, your tribe depends upon it. But what purpose does it serve to be so sensitive to slights in a culture where the state is strong? If you have need to take recourse, you could take recourse. Just trying to figure out what cultural or sociological purpose does being sensitive to microaggressions serve?
Well, we don't explain these phenomena so much with their purposes or end goals. The purpose for an individual engaging in any of these behaviors can vary.
Sure.
But we focus more on the structural conditions that shape this. And one of the things we argue is that when you have a mixture of very easy access to third parties, such as superiors or to the public opinion as a whole through the electronic mob, this facilitates relying on complaint to third party, perhaps to the point of becoming over-reliance on third party. People might lose their willingness or ability to even respond verbally to something they find awkward or offensive and say, maybe you shouldn't say that, or here's why this is offensive, or I disagree with you. And so complaining becomes more attractive as a strategy.
The people doing this who are making the microaggression complaints and these things would see their, I mean, what, from their standpoint, they would say that the reason is that there's all this oppression and we have to combat it. Now, one of the things that has interested us is that these kinds of complaints about these minor offenses occur in environments where you have fewer major offenses, right? More, fewer macro aggressions. So these elite universities are highly tolerant environments, and there's very little overt racism and that kind of thing. That it's a highly egalitarian but also diverse society. So, most egalitarian societies in the past, when I say society, I just mean a group of egalitarian social settings in the past have not been so diverse. But there is a lot of diversity. What happens in an environment where there's a lot of equality is that people are, are concerned if you put someone down in some way or, elevate yourself above someone. And where there's a lot of diversity, then people become very concerned with putting down particular groups, particular cultural groups. So what is seen as offensive then, in these environments, what's seen as most offensive is putting down a minority, an oppressed cultural group. And so they end up focusing on very, even minor incidents of that. It's partly then because of the lack of macroaggressions that there's this concern for microaggressions.
Gotcha. So the point you guys make in the paper is that the victimhood culture, the culture of victimhood is a combination of honor and dignity culture. So it takes the sensitivity to slights of the honor culture with the relying on third parties to mete out justice for you of the dignity culture, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And just to be clear, like one of you all just said that doesn't have to be necessarily an authority, right? It doesn't have to necessarily be the campus administration or the police. What a lot of these individuals who use microaggressions, like they go online, like you said, there's a website dedicated to listing out microaggressions, and then they'll tweet it out in the hopes of boning up support of the offenses that they've felt they've received.
Correct. You definitely see a lot of online complaint in this manner. And in a sense, the public at large, if one has access to a large number of listeners or viewers or other potential supporters, that third party, due to its size, is almost like an authority. I mean, conceivably, somebody's life could be derailed because of large-scale public shaming or complaining.
Okay.
One of the things, too, is to say about what people are doing. I mean, you can have various reasons for making the complaint, but we're saying that, the reason we called it a victimhood culture is because victimhood becomes a kind of status instead of honor. So honor is a form of status, dignity somewhat, except that it's, the idea is that everybody holds it, unless you do something. Yeah. But this is you get a kind of status from being a victim. And so there is this incentive then to claim victimhood. You get, there are not only personal benefits that might accrue. You might get invited to the White House if you're, the point he was arrested for making the clock, and then he's invited to the White House not because he did anything so praiseworthy, but because he was victimized. And so victimhood becomes a kind of status. You can see that there would be an incentive at the individual level to to make claims of victimhood, but also then as a political tactic. So it is part of mobilizing people for a political cause, for fighting oppression and things that they're seeing there. And so they're trying to show this pattern of victimization. And that's one thing. And we can talk about this maybe later too, but when we're talking about a victimhood culture, we see it maybe elements of it are throughout throughout American society, but we really only see a full-blown victimhood culture within certain college campuses, and it wouldn't be even dominant among the students necessarily there. But so it's a very kind of small enclaves where it's rising. Maybe it's going to get bigger.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that incentive to become a victim, you all give examples of individuals who create, falsify instances of being a victim so they can get that, support or maybe to further a political cause. Can you talk about some of those examples of people creating faux outrage just to, I don't know why, just because they get the attention they want?
Well, we talked a little about hate crime hoaxes. And so this is, it's something we also see on campuses and from the same circles of people who are broadcasting microaggression complaints and asking for trigger warnings and these things. I mean, obviously, this is something that is not, it's not exactly the same kind of thing, because everybody, most people would of course condemn you if you lie about being a victim. But you see these popping up at universities, these hate crime hoaxes, where someone, so in this case, so we talked about the idea that microaggression complaints are made where there aren't very many macroaggressions. But one thing to do is, if you wanted to point to some macroaggressions and there aren't any, you can make them up. So we've seen examples of people who have eventually victimized themselves. There was a woman at one of the Claremont colleges in California, who was a visiting assistant professor, and she slashed her tires. She was going to speak at an anti-racism event. She slashed her tires and wrote racial slurs on the car and these kinds of things to make it look like she was the victim of racists. And there have been other examples like that too. Someone at Duke University hanging a black doll up in a noose. We're getting to look like white racists had done it, but it was the anti-racist activist who had.
Interesting.
So good example of people, where you see people claiming victimhood even when they haven't been victimized.
Yeah, and there's been instances when I've seen that where it come to find out it's a hoax, and then you see these individuals who are who are really keyed into promoting a cause. They'll say, well, it was a hoax, but it rose awareness. Right, we're having this conversation. That's important. And I can understand, we need to discuss this sort of stuff. But then the idea that it's based on a false premise, it's like, well, I don't know. It takes the winds out of the sails of your point you're trying to make. Another interesting point you all made was that even individuals who aren't victims, but are actually considered the dominant group, will use the culture of victimhood, correct? So affirmative action is reverse racism, or like individuals who are the targets of, who are supposedly doing these microaggressions. Well, I'm the victim here. Like I'm the one who's being called out on Twitter, and it's my life is miserable. So it seems like everyone wants to get a piece of the victimhood action.
And that's one thing I find fascinating about various kinds of human behavior, including kinds of conflict management, is that they sometimes have this self-replicating or self-reinforcing quality. One example that occurs to us is gangs. You drop a violence gang into a neighborhood without a stable legal system, and other gangs form to defend themselves from this initial gang. And they might victimize others in turn, creating still more gangs. And I think what we see in this spread of victim culture is a similar phenomenon. When the structural conditions are right, sometimes the most effective way to defend yourself from an accusation of being privileged and dominant is to point to how you actually are victimized and to rely on the same language and style of complaining as your opponents. And you even see this with people who might be personally opposed to framing conflicts in that way or using this tactic. They find the most efficient way to shut down the opposition or gain some support in the debate is to use the very same tactic of complaining of victimhood that they might condemn otherwise. There's an interesting example from blogger Megan McArdle, who talks about how she was in an argument with somebody and he was accusing her of microaggressing, and she responded that he was mansplaining to her, meaning to point out that this is how easy it is to microaggress, but it actually worked and shut down the argument. She's like, no, my point wasn't to shut you down, but it illustrates how easily one can do that.
Yeah, that's really funny. So, I mean, I guess the downside of this, so like honor cultures had this, the idea was that you create this vicious cycle of blood feuding, right? Dignity mm-hmm. cultures, whenever I read your paper, I'm a big fan of dignity culture. But with victimhood culture, it seems like the downside would be that, okay, you're using this tactic to resolve conflict, but if both parties can use it, then conflict never gets resolved, right? on a meta level, right? I mean, if you can call someone a victim, or you say yourself a victim, the other person say they're victims, like, the problem still exists, but nothing's happened.
Yeah, one thing, I mean, in thinking of what might be the downsides, I mean, if honor culture leads to a lot of conflict, and it's violent conflict in that case, but that it's the same thing here. I mean, dignity, the idea is that if you're ignoring lots of slights, you're not letting conflicts get going, right? You're essentially tolerating a lot of behavior that you do find offensive. But you can see that how that would help people to have relationships with people, to have civil relationships and to not have a lot of conflict. Well, if you're encouraging people to take offense at slights, then it's not like that somehow solves something. It often, as you're saying, it provokes responses. I mean, people don't like being called racists or because of whatever they said in a conversation. You're likely to promote more conflict. That's one thing. Conflict leads to conflict, and so by making complaints over minor matters, you're definitely going to increase the amount of conflict. Again, maybe that's a good thing. I don't think it is, but I mean, you can see somebody arguing that, we don't need to ignore these things because they're so important. They're doing so much harm. We don't say ignore it if somebody is violent towards you. We say call the police. So there are, we don't, but yeah, you're going to have more conflict or you might have people avoiding one another. If you're going to offend someone when you talk to them and try to have a conversation, maybe you just don't bother. So those are the kinds of things where it seems like it's unlikely to accomplish what those who are promoting the idea want. I mean, they're not wanting more conflict, more racial and other kinds of conflict, and more avoidance of one another.
Interesting. So you guys talk a little bit too about the conflict between conflict management styles. We're seeing this now with this as we're transitioning in some areas of the country. We want to reiterate, this is like not happening on a culture-wide level. Some people think that, but it's happening in very few segmented places. But there's conflicts between these two different types of moral cultures. So you have the individuals who are appealing to a victimhood culture, bumping up against these people who are the dignity culture of people. How is that manifesting itself? I guess the only place you see it manifest is in the blogosphere or in magazines or newspapers. I mean, are you seeing manifestations of that conflict?
I would say certainly we are seeing manifestations of it in the sense that people will write blogs and articles complaining about the oversensitivity of college students or the activist set, who in turn will write blogs and articles complaining about the insensitivity of others who condemn them or don't understand the nature of their complaints.
Gotcha. And I'm curious too. So you all talk about in the paper that that cultures of morality influence other aspects of life, right? So a culture of honor made people like very sensitive to insults They worked on being warlike so they can be ready to like pounce and go after a guy if he needed to. How is a culture of victimhood influencing other aspects of just daily life?
There's so many examples here. Maybe Jason will have some too, but I mean, I could just give two. One is the idea of safe spaces. So you see a lot of the same language, when you're thinking of microaggressions, it's like somebody has done a kind of violence to you by using the word. But one of the terms used by activists is this idea of a safe space. So sometimes the idea is that the whole college should be a safe space. Sometimes there are particular places. There was last fall, so 1 year ago at Brown University, a speaker, Wendy McElroy, who considers herself kind of a libertarian feminist, but she came to speak at a debate kind of thing with another feminist. And the idea was that she was going to criticize the term rape culture and critique that. And there was a group on campus that created a safe space, which was a room where there was Play-Doh and coloring books and cookies and people could escape from the talk if they needed to, and come to the safe space. And so, you know, one student who made use of this safe space said, "I was feeling bombarded by a lot of viewpoints that really go against my dearly and closely held beliefs." So the idea is that if you're bombarded by viewpoints that go against your beliefs, you're made unsafe. It's something that, you know, you have to get away from. I mean, I think somebody recently said, if you've gone through 4 years of college and you haven't, you know, had your views challenged, you should get your money back. You know, so the old idea would be it's good to be challenged in your beliefs. And this is that, you know, not only is it not good, but it's something that's actually harming you that you need to be protected from.
Something that's equated with violence.
Yeah.
Considered a form of destruction or violence to offend or to challenge someone's beliefs or make them uncomfortable in any way.
And the you know, as thinking of other things, you know, one in honor cultures, people boast about their bravery and things like that. And one of the things in dignity cultures, you're supposed to be really modest. Don't boast. And so we would tend to see that in victimhood cultures, people are more likely to boast about being a victim and about their weakness. You know, so when I started seeing on letters that students would write, like in applications for graduate school or for awards and things, they would all be focused on all these horrible things that have happened to them. You know, instead of focusing on what I can do. I mean, you can kind of see that some of it is. Some of it isn't necessarily victim, but it's the idea that I've overcome these things. But a lot of it is not. And I think, you know, there's that parallel with honor, and also in honor cultures where you might shame cowards. You know, in victimhood culture, you know, there's this shaming of the privileged and the shaming of oppressors. So people tell people, check your privilege and things like that, which is, you know, kind of the equivalent. You see, if a coward is the worst thing you can be in honor culture, then being blind, you know, privileged but blind to it is or an actual oppressor is the worst thing that you can be in.
Yeah. So Beowulf wouldn't have a good time on American campuses, or Achilles. Yeah. I think this is interesting, this whole idea. So this idea that victimhood culture arises when things are extremely diverse, egalitarian, the state is the power, the state is strong. But at the same time, as you said, that it sort of forces people to turn inwards because they don't want to get out and mix it up with people and the fear that they're going to possibly offend. And it seems like, I'm just kind of following this, and I mean, I know you guys don't really take this leap in your paper, but it seems like victimhood culture could actually destroy the thing, like it could destroy democracy in a way. The thing that made victimhood culture possible, like victimhood culture will destroy it. Everyone has to turn inwards and like not actually mix it up with people that are different from them because they might be offended. I don't know. I'm just speculating there. I know you guys don't do that in your paper. You're just sociology. You guys are describing. You're not Nostradamus or prescribing.
We're maybe doing some of it, a little bit of it in something we're writing now. So Jason, do you want to?
Yeah, I'm curious. Like, where are you going to take this work that you've done? Where are you going to go with it?
So we're hopefully we'll write a book. But right now we're writing an article that's kind of a response to some of the criticisms and things that we've gotten, and we're trying to.
Has there been a lot of criticism?
Whole lot, actually. A lot of the response has been positive.
A lot of it, yeah. There. So I guess
there have been some misunderstandings.
Sure.
There have been, you know, so. Connor Friedersdorf published something in The Atlantic about it, and he published a multi-part series, and one of them was where he was publishing readers' complaints about the term victimhood culture. And so, yeah, you have people saying, well, the term victimhood culture is a microaggression. And one person said, you know, it's a microaggression, actually a real aggression, you know. So, which, you know, is kind of to be expected, right, if we're saying that, you know, that the adherents of this culture take offense very easily. They take offense at the name that we've given it to. But you know, we have reasons for that. We know that for the use of the term that you know. But yeah, that's been the most of it. That they see the term as offensive, and then there are various arguments. So I've tried to to think about. I mean, when we in our article, especially we're describing something and trying to describe and explain, and we're not issuing moral condemnations, but it is, I think it is useful. And this is, sociological work can be useful in understanding in helping make moral decisions, right? Even though it can't kind of say what's right or wrong. But if you're thinking about the consequences, the natural consequences of particular cultures, you know, as I said before, victimhood culture is going to lead to more conflict. Now, maybe you'll decide the trade-offs are worth it, but you can even think about, you know, what are the trade-offs? So one thing would be, are microaggressions even causing a lot of harm? And so Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt posted a big piece in The Atlantic that got a lot of attention, The Coddling of the American Mind. And what they said is that, that if you draw on insights from psychology, right, from therapy, the idea is usually that, you don't want to magnify things and make them bigger than they are. Imagine that you know people's intentions when you don't. And so they see these things, microaggression complaints, demands for trigger warnings and stuff, as probably harming the people who are who they're intended to help, because they're making them not only unprepared for society at large, but probably leading to anxiety and depression and these other things. I think it's also, if in dignity culture the idea is that there is this powerful state, but we don't invoke it for small things, only for big things, right? And so that's kind of, there's that discrepancy, because you want general freedom in your life, except if there's violence and things like that, and then you want the Leviathan to come in, right, and suppress it. But if if you invoke the Leviathan for every little thing, then you really are going to destroy the kind of liberal democratic order that has been associated with dignity, I think. So I think
that, right. And that is one example we draw on in our discussion, talking about social control in totalitarian societies. And I'm not making some claim we're headed towards totalitarianism. I'm not being an alarmist. But we do talk about how one of the things that makes totalitarian societies totalitarian is that people can drag the state into every little dispute, usually by accusing their neighbor of being disloyal or whatever, being part of some category that will attract social control from the state. And a lot of the executions you see in a place like Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia are people informing on each other as a means of handling their conflicts. So I'm not making the argument we're near that in any way, but this, your point about democracy made me think of this, that carrying forward this culture of complaint far enough in one direction, you get something that looks like totalitarianism.
Interesting.
It would be totalitarianism if it were the state doing it, right? Wouldn't it, Jason? I mean, it's something. There's something like it on college campuses that's arising. But the difference is, of course, that they're not executing people; they're just banning speakers. I mean, which is less of a consequence. But there is this kind of mindset. I mean, there was the University of Manchester recently had two journalists in to talk. Here was going to be the talk. From liberation to censorship, does modern feminism have a problem with free speech? And there were two speakers coming in and talk about this. Then both of the speakers got banned by the student union. They can't come. And they said that it was because, there was an editorial, that was another incident, actually. But you see this happening all the time. Speakers being banned. The idea is that they can't even come on a campus and speak because they're going to imperil people's safety. So that's a totalitarian mindset, even though it's nothing like being sent to the gulag, but
I think you even see it online, right? Like when individuals who do something like microaggress online, like they could be completely shamed on the internet, and like their life in the real world could be ruined. Like they lose a job, people send, people drive by their house and threatening phone calls, like say they're going to kill me. Like, I guess who was, there's something like, what's that French philosopher's name? Foucault.
Panopticon, yeah.
Yeah, he said basically, like, you know, the state isn't going to be the one who comes in with the totalitarianism, like with the jack-heeled boot against our throat. It'll just be like, we'll all just welcome it because we're all watching each other, and we'll just suddenly watch ourselves. Like, that's how totalitarianism comes. Like, we just sort of allow it to happen because we're always constantly watching each other with our devices and our smartphones and the internet and all this stuff. It's interesting stuff. And I'm curious too. And I know you guys are sociologists and you're academics and you're trying to be descriptive, but I mean, I think you don't want to cast moral judgment. I mean, it sounds like it's in your interest though, as academics you guys got some skin in the game. What you just said, that people objected to the idea of victimhood culture, like how does, I mean, it seems like victimhood culture could get in the way of academic pursuits, because people will say, well, that's what you're doing is offending me, even though it might be true, right? Like, I mean, it could prohibit people from academics from exploring uncomfortable truths that might be a net benefit to society, but it gets shut down because doesn't feel safe.
Exactly. And while we don't pass any judgments at all in our original paper, we did write an editorial for the Chronicle of Higher Education calling for academic freedom. You know, however, whatever position you take in this debate about microaggressions and so forth, you have to recognize and preserve academic freedom, or else you've given away the game. That the spirit of free inquiry requires we say things that are new and that might challenge people's beliefs and that are likely to cause offense somewhere down the line. You can't have free inquiry without offense.
And that's one of the reasons we're not activists and we don't normally make judgments and didn't in the academic article. But we did make an exception there because, as you said, we are academics, and this is crucial to our ability to be able to do our work. You can't have if the university is going to be an environment where people pursue knowledge, then people are going to be offended. And it's you can't have an environment like that that's free of offense. And so, you know, we're definitely. I certainly don't mind saying, you know, that I am critical of these things. I don't see, you know, that, I mean, a university trying to deal with microaggression and then to say, well, opposition to affirmative action is a microaggression, that's banned, you know, and even they say that we're not banning it, it's just advice. But what does that mean if you're in your faculty training, you're telling people not to say these things? What ultimately happens if someone says it? So it's either pointless or it really does limit academic freedom.
Very interesting. Well, Bradley and Jason, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'm sure we could just talk more about it. But thank you so much for your time. Where can people learn more about the work or read the paper themselves if they wanted to?
Google. Online. Okay. On various,
that's where I found
locations.
It.
But if we're the first result to come up with our names in the paper title.
Okay.
Yeah, so Microaggression and Moral Cultures is the title of our original paper. And there have been other things written about it. Jonathan Haidt at his blog called The Righteous Mind wrote a post and many others. So it's pretty easy, should be easy for people to find, or they can certainly look us up and contact us if they want it.
Fantastic. Well, Bradley Campbell, Jason Manning, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Brad.
My guests today were Bradley Campbell and Jason Manning. They are sociologists, and you can find their paper. You just got to Google it. Google honor, dignity, victimhood. You're going to find it. That's how I found it. Go check it out. I think you'll really enjoy it. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. That'll help us get some feedback on how we can improve the show, but also spread the word about the show. As always, I appreciate your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.